This excellent medical student-led podcast is for educational purposes only and not intended to be used as medical advice under any circumstance.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Alert and Oriented podcast post-MASH, and we are back, baby. This is Nathan Kulapur here with my partner in crime, Kaushik Kandapi and Kevin Krasinski. How are you guys doing?
I am doing phenomenal, my friend. And Nathan kind of beat me to the punch a little bit, but I want to give him a quick shout out for an incredible, incredible match this past week. My friend is going to be taking his talents to the greater Boston area at Beth Israel. So look out for him and shout out to our boy. It was amazing.
Thank you, Kaushik. Very kind of you. Appreciate it. Congrats to you too, man. Gonna stay home here in Chicago. They're lucky to have you here at Rush.
There we go.
We'll be joining Dr. Abrams over at Rush. We're really excited and excited for Nathan too. Really proud of these guys.
That's awesome, man. Back to where Alert and Oriented was born. I love it.
Yeah. Exciting times on the horizon. Well, we are thrilled because we have two of our very good friends, Michael and Nami, here with us on the podcast today. So I'll go ahead and kick it over to them and let them introduce themselves.
Yeah, I'm Michael, also a fourth-year medical student matched into family medicine.
Awesome. Where are you going?
I'll be at U Chicago for the next 3 years.
Yes, sir.
I'm Nami, also a fourth-year med student, and I'll be joining Kaushik in internal medicine at Rush.
Yay. Yeah. Here we go. So we got a two-for-one deal on the podcast today. It's beautiful.
Yeah, I'm telling you guys, Rush and Chicago about to get some absolute stud. All right. Well, without further ado, let's jump into the podcast. We've got a really good case for you today. So Kaushik, you want to give us our one-liner?
Yes, sir. So as we all know here at Alert and Oriented, we always like to start very broad, just get a line of thinking going and see what we can do with the diagnostic framework. So broad chief complaint today, we have a 37-year-old female with no past medical history who presented to the ED with 2 weeks of worsening fatigue and abdominal discomfort. And that is all we have right now as far as information. So the first thing that we're always curious about with taking a big chief complaint and trying to make it manageable is thinking about diagnostic frameworks. How do you start to form a differential with this kind of information? So we would just love to hear, what are you guys thinking right now? What other information do you have? What's going through your head?
I'd want to know maybe where the pain is. Mm-hmm. If it's, say, like in the right upper quadrant, I'd be thinking maybe more something with the liver or more epigastric, then I would think something like reflux or gastric ulcer, gastritis, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think when patients come in with abdominal pain, abdominal discomfort, I totally agree taking the anatomical approach and getting a sense of where is this pain. Is it even located in a certain quadrant? Does it radiate anywhere? Is it diffuse too? And I think that's a great place to start. We seem to have an acute presentation as well. And so I think from there we can kind of build into then how does fatigue build into how is patients presenting.
Yeah, I would also keep like gynecologic things in mind, like the 37-year-old female pregnancy, ectopic pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And right now we have fatigue and abdominal discomfort. Are you guys thinking about those as related, not related? And is there anything that you're looking for as far as HPI that might help you down that road a little bit?
One good unifying diagnosis could potentially be some sort of anemia, potentially a GI bleed. Obviously, mm-hmm. I don't want to just anchor on that, but I would love in the HPI to get a sense of, has there been any change in the stools, in color? Is it looser? Or do you have like, does this patient have bright red stools or black stools to kind of maybe differentiate if this patient has a GI bleed where that could be occurring?
Yeah, amazing. So I feel like what we've heard so far is thinking about a differential for abdominal pain from an anatomic standpoint, you know, trying to divide the abdomen into, you know, rough quadrants or rough areas where we can think about it on an organ by organ basis. And then here, you know, with fatigue and abdominal discomfort with this kind of acute presentation, could be related, could be separate, but you just mentioned a lot of really good things we're looking for on history that can kind of point us that direction. And, you know, when you're talking about frameworks and things like that, I personally am not the smartest guy around. So that really speaks to me as far as diagnostic frameworks and trying to keep things simple and thinking. So let's see if we can get you guys some more information.
Yeah. All right. So here's some more history. Symptoms started 2 weeks ago with nausea and diffuse mild abdominal pain. It progressed to decreased appetite and minimal to no food intake over the past few days. She's had no vomiting or diarrhea. No hematochezia, melena, fever, or chills. Urine has become really dark, but not red. Last menstrual period was 3 weeks ago, It was regular, not heavy. And she was prescribed trazodone and duloxetine for major depressive disorder 3 weeks ago. She took those for 1 day and then stopped. These medications predated the start of her symptoms. So, a little bit more information now. How is this, you know, affecting what you're thinking?
Sorry, just to confirm. So, how long had this patient been taking trazodone and duloxetine?
Just one day.
Oh, just one
day. She took those pills for 1 day.
And they stopped. Yes. Okay, great. So, I mean, I'm less concerned about like a GI bleed picture, though I don't want to totally eliminate that from the differential. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the fact that she has had decreased PO intake makes me wonder if there's some sort of like obstruction. Things like gastroparesis can cause like nausea, vomiting, and like an ability to tolerate PO. I'm very worried that whatever is like ultimately causing her symptoms and resulted in her not being able to tolerate like oral nutrition is like affecting her kidneys, and that she's having mm-hmm. some sort of like AKI, especially with the dark urine. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. Some things I'm like thinking about, I want to know like alcohol and substance use history, because this could be some kind of presentation of cirrhosis. And yeah, I also want to know like travel history, if there's any weird infection she could have picked up somewhere.
Mm-hmm. No alcohol use, no tobacco use, no drug use, no recent travel, lives suburbs of Chicago.
But all really good questions, right?
Yeah.
Those are all really important to know as part of the history.
Yeah. I would love to get a sense of what other medications this patient takes, if any, because I know we have this kind of overlapping history of starting trazodone and duloxetine, just taking it for 1 week or 1 day, sorry. Mm-hmm. But would love to see if there's anything else that could potentially be explaining her symptoms mm-hmm. or contribute.
Yeah, there's some great thoughts. So we've thrown a few things out there. So initially, you want to maybe say like, maybe like top, you know, several things on your differential right now.
With things so vague right now, it's hard to narrow in. So in cases like this, where you're really still trying to gather information, you got to be thinking about your can't miss diagnoses. You've mentioned GI bleed being one. What are some others on the can't miss side, things with everything else being so broad that we got to keep our minds on?
Bowel obstruction, mm-hmm. malignancy could also be like related to like causing a bowel obstruction.
You mentioned some gynecologic things as well.
Mm-hmm. Pregnancy, ectopic, although like less likely with the last regular periods, but still not out of the question.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Is there anything you guys are looking for specifically on exam?
Masses. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Peritonitic signs.
Great. Yeah.
Totally.
Great. All right. So let's go and examine the patient. Patrick, want to give us the physical exam?
Yeah. So you get in the room with the patient, and first you're checking their vital signs, their afebrile, heart rate's 100 to 110, respiratory rate 14 to 16, pressures are ranging from 125 to 140 over 70s, setting O2 sat is 99%. Generally, she looks okay, no acute distress. She does have some scleral icterus. On CV exam, she's tachycardic without any sort of murmur that you can appreciate. Respiratory exam shows normal work of breathing, lungs are clear. On her abdominal exam, she is non-distended. She has right upper quadrant tenderness to palpation. On her extremity exam, there's no lower extremity edema. Neurologically, she is alert and oriented. She doesn't have any focal neurological deficits and no asterixis. And on skin exam, you do notice that she is jaundiced appearing even from the door. So on this exam, what stands out to you?
Jaundice, scleral icterus, and the right upper quadrant tenderness. Mm-hmm. Make me think some kind of liver pathology.
For sure. And I think just initial kind of gut feeling when you see this physical, you see these vitals, you know, thinking about our sick, not sick assessment whenever we see patients and how worried we have to be about them. Is there anything that screams out to you right now about this patient as far as whether they are sick or not sick, and how worried are you?
Pulse is kind of high, so that makes me think
cardio.
A little sick.
Her blood pressure is like compensated though, so I am like worried that she could be like dehydrated, obviously, because she just hasn't been eating, but like her heart rate is able to compensate and like get her blood pressure high enough, which makes me not as worried about her being terribly sick.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And Nami, I think you brought up a really good point about the heart rate. I remember once I had a wonderful ED attending who once said that unexplained tachycardia is the scariest thing that you can see in a patient. So I think that was a really good point. Michael, totally, when it comes to the blood pressure, is, you know, something that we're keeping our eye on. and definitely want to see how it trends.
Yeah. And what do you make of the neuro exam here?
The fact that she doesn't have asterisks also makes me, you know, a little more relieved as opposed to potentially her being in like a like acute like hepatic failure. Acute liver failure, sorry.
Okay. All right. Good. Great thoughts. All right. So we're going to get some lab work, but are there any initial like orders you would put in, you know, after this exam and getting the history that you want to check on labs?
Definitely would want to get liver function tests, as well as just like, I feel like getting a CBC to see if there's any signs of infection, potentially, BMP, see if there's any electrolyte abnormalities.
We got the hepatitis panel, liver stuff.
Which ones?
Yeah, there's like all those different things with hep B or something. I don't
remember. Like surface antibody versus surface antigen core, all those.
Yeah.
Another hep E too. Don't forget about hep E. Yeah,
exactly.
Is D, is that one?
There's ABCD.
ABCD, yeah. But D's, maybe. D is the one that's associated with hep B type, right? Yeah.
Super infection. And then C is more chronic.
Yeah. Still can cause acute, but you think of it as more chronic picture.
And then, like, right upper quadrant ultrasound, like gallstones, cholecystitis, cholecystoma, all those things.
Mm-hmm. Assessing, like, even just, like, the, like, with POCUS, assessing the IVC to just see what her fluid status is. She doesn't have any lower extremity edema, but she potentially could benefit from fluids, but just want to make sure she's not overloaded before doing that.
Yeah. All right. Great, great initial order set. All right. So we're going to get some labs back here. All right, so on CBC, white blood cell count is 15 with neutrophilic predominance. Hemoglobin is 12, which is consistent with her baseline. Platelets are 350. For chemistries, sodium is 134, potassium 4.1, chloride 101, bicarb 24, BUN 25, and creatinine 0.8, which is at baseline. ALT is 2,590, AST 1,595. INR 2.6, T bili 16.1, and albumin 2.5. Labs come back negative for ethanol as well as phosphatidyl ethanol, negative Utox, negative Tylenol and salicylate levels, negative pregnancy test, and CT abdomen pelvis imaging is normal. So, a lot there. What do you make of these?
Boy, oh boy.
Very well put, my friend.
Well, the ALT, AST are really high.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the INR is kind of elevated, showing like decreased clotting factors and liver function.
Mm-hmm. Increased total bilirubin as well. And then no, like, just with the negative Tylenol, like, no, like, kind of cursory, like, medication that could potentially be provoking this. Mm-hmm. She does have a loop, which leads me maybe towards more of an infectious picture.
Yeah. So these. Yeah, you mentioned some of these key labs that are coming back. Like the white blood cell count is pretty high. You know, liver enzymes sky high. Elevated INR, bilirubin. Albumin is a little bit low. Yeah, so in terms of interpreting these and thinking about your differential, where do you feel like you're leaning towards?
I'm kind of leaning towards like maybe like one of the hepatitises. I know there's also, I don't know if you remember, like some, there's like the autoimmune
hepatitis.
Liver. Yeah, autoimmune hepatitis.
Yeah. Which could be happening. I feel like I usually, you know, she did start two new medications. I feel like I would expect a patient to be on like a new medication for a week or two or, you know, some sustained period of time, but definitely something to keep in mind, you know, if it's not an infectious hepatitis.
So but, thinking broad categories of hepatitis right now, because that's really what we have, right? We have acute time course, markedly elevated liver enzyme tests, signs of synthetic dysfunction.
Infectious.
Yeah, and you mean, no, I'm just sharing back what I'm hearing from you guys.
Yes.
You're thinking about infections, you're thinking about autoimmune processes, you're thinking about medications. Any other big buckets of acute liver injury?
Malignant. But I guess, I don't think that would be acute or as acute.
Like some sort of like biliary, like obstructive biliary process could cause acute liver injury.
Sure.
We mentioned medications as well. Not like the autoimmune related like medications, but like Tylenol, which we did test for.
Yeah, just to round it out, the biggest one probably is actually ischemic. Okay. So in hypotensive, really sick shock patients, you can get ischemic hepatitis. And that shows this picture. Just the liver's not getting the blood flow it needs. And then drug-induced liver injury. And then a big one is coagulopathy, specifically blood chiari.
Yeah.
And then genetic stuff, but that's does not really fit in the picture for her. So.
Yeah, all right. So leaning on this hepatitis train, thought about the different causes there. And Michael, you had mentioned earlier with the neuro exam, you're less concerned for acute liver failure. So I just wanted to talk for a moment about acute liver injury versus acute liver failure, because there's very specific definitions for these two. So acute liver injury is rapid onset liver dysfunction characterized by significant elevations in the transaminases. That's acute liver injury. For acute liver failure, it's a severe form of acute liver injury characterized by impaired synthetic function, noted by an INR greater than or equal to 1.5, and hepatic encephalopathy that develops within 26 weeks in a patient with a previously normal liver. So they can't have pre-existing underlying liver disease. Acute liver failure has a very high mortality rate and requires prompt intensive care management with possibility of liver transplantation. So that's why it's really important to rule that out as a must not miss diagnosis. And we know that here she does have synthetic dysfunction, but we haven't gotten any signs of hepatic encephalopathy. So currently she would not be considered to be an acute liver failure. All right. And for acute liver failure, viral and drug or toxin induced causes, those are the most common causes. But there are a host of other things that can cause it. So at this point, any thoughts on what we should do?
I think Nami did a great, mention it before, would love to get a viral hepatitis panel and see if there's some sort of infectious cause.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if she's at the ED at a community hospital, do you have any idea where she should go from there?
Tertiary.
Yeah.
Hospital.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Why?
Because
in case she develops encephalopathy and
that. Flint. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's the big thing. So, all right, let's see what happens. Kaushik, want to give us the sequel here?
Yes, sir. So, based on Nami's advice, this patient was transferred to a tertiary care hospital that did have a liver transplant center for escalation of care. On further HPI, you note that this patient was not taking any supplements and no medicines other than that one day of trazodone and duloxetine. You do get an ultrasound of the liver with Doppler, and it shows patent hepatic vasculature with mild hepatomegaly. You also get a few more labs back showing factor 5 activity of 32%, fibrinogen is 110, FOS is 2.6, glucose 60 to 80, ferritin is in the 3000s, and all of the acute liver injury labs are sent, including Hep A, B, C, E, EBV, CMV, HSV, adenovirus, Wilson's, HIV. And you also check an ANA, anti-smooth muscle antibody, anti-liver kidney microsome, and anti-soluble liver antigen with quantitative Igs. And you also do Q4 neuro exams, but based on the husband's report, this patient is neurologically at her baseline. So a lot of information, once again, that we're giving you. But what we have right now is that this patient was transferred from the community setting here to a tertiary care hospital with a liver transplant center. And now we have a little bit more history, a little bit more imaging, and some more labs as well. So is there anything here that helps clear up the picture a little bit or steer you one direction or another? What are your thoughts about all this?
Yeah, the liver Doppler kind of pulls me away from some sort of coagulation disorder, but Chiari, just because there was nothing within the hepatic vasculature. I know we're still waiting on all of the infectious labs. Less worried about some sort of, now I'm losing my words. Less worried about some sort of autoimmune due to or some sort of medication induced, just given that this patient is not any other medication, so it could be autoimmune.
Yeah.
Wonderful. I think that what we just talked about a couple minutes ago was thinking about hepatitis in terms of these buckets. And what we were just able to do is really start to funnel down within those buckets and say, this is less likely, this is more likely. And I think we, based on what I just heard you say, Michael, there are a couple of buckets that we kind of put to the side and say, these are less likely. We're going to focus our attention elsewhere.
And this was really just the inclusion of some of the other labs is to paint a picture of the overall liver function. Mm-hmm. This is something I didn't learn until actually being on hepatology service, but you trend these markers, the factor five, fibrinogen as signs of worsening coagulopathy, and then the phosphorus and glucose you actually are keeping an eye on because your liver is doing gluconeogenesis, and if you start becoming more hypoglycemic, that's just a sign of more impending liver dysfunction. So these are being trended, and then the ferritin being elevated, not really helpful other than we know that something, it's an acute phase reaction, right? Something inflammatory is happening.
And I feel like we can also kind of start to appreciate here too, like we mentioned with the physical exam, you know, with the vital signs, with the things we saw on exam, you know, this might not have been the most acutely toxic appearing patient, but, you know, with these labs and kind of with this clinical picture that's starting to evolve, you know, this is certainly a pretty sick patient, you know, who we wanted to transfer to a tertiary care hospital, have a liver transplant service, keeping an eye on them at very close call, and someone who we're, you know, pretty worried about is on our service right now.
Yeah. All right. Great work so far, guys. We'll go ahead and get some of these labs back. Yeah. So ANA comes back with titer greater than 1 to 1,280. IgA is 456, which is normal. IgM is 108, which is normal. And IgG is 2,805, very elevated. So at this point, well, one, what do you make of that? And then what do you think the next step would be?
That's high, like one, that's high, right? Yes. Like in ANA, okay.
Yeah.
They diluted it to like 1/1200.
Okay, at least we're getting with those numbers.
And we're still able to detect it, right?
So. Yeah. Okay, so this pointing more towards some kind of autoimmune process.
And so, okay, yeah, but you're right, because we have, you know, high immunoglobulin levels, high like INA titer. If you want to get a good look at the hepatic, you know, architecture, what would be the next step to do that?
Liver biopsy.
Liver biopsy, all right. So you call up your colleagues, they come get the liver biopsy, and here are the results. So it shows liver biopsy shows panlobular bridging necrosis with interface activity, 70 to 80%. That is very bad. Marked mixed inflammation with innumerable plasma cells. And you're unable to evaluate for fibrosis given the degree of necrosis. So overall, liver is not having a good time.
Not many normal liver cells there.
Yeah. So you guys mentioned you're leaning more, thinking more like autoimmune at this point. Which of the labs that we've said you think would help you most in like being really confident in that diagnosis?
Like the, like out of those or the previous ones?
Or like ones we had sent before that we haven't gotten back yet.
Yeah. In this whole gamut right here.
Like the anti-smooth muscle.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what the other two are.
Yeah, I don't know the specificity of the other ones. I don't know if smooth muscle is like 100% specific for liver. Yeah, I know ANA is the most non-specific, so.
Yeah, you're right. There's a whole host of like antibodies you can look for, but yes, anti-smooth muscle is going to be our like best bet with like the sensitivity and specificity. Okay. So we will get those results back. And it comes back at 1 to 640. That is a high positive. So, just to summarize here, with this lab value, what is our final diagnosis?
Autoimmune hepatitis.
Autoimmune hepatitis. Yeah, good work, guys.
You got it.
Yeah, you crushed it. You were thinking of that from early on, and yeah.
I remember you guys mentioned that like very early, you know, even on when we were talking about physical exam, someone said autoimmune hepatitis. You guys were on it.
Yeah.
It's a really difficult diagnosis to clinch to. There's some scoring criteria that you can use to kind of help say, you know, definitive probable diagnosis. And it's really based on clinical picture, liver enzyme tests, autoimmune markers, immunoglobulin, and some of the specific antibodies. So the smooth muscle, liver, kidney, microsomin, soluble liver antigen, and then the biopsy, the pathology. So necrosis, interface activity, and then presence of plasma cells really kind of start pushing you towards this diagnosis.
All right. So in terms of the resolution for this case, the patient was started on high-dose prednisone, but unfortunately had worsening liver enzymes, coagulopathy, and liver synthetic function. So had expedited liver transplant evaluation. Her MELD score was 38, and she was listed for transplant. MELD stands for Model for End-Stage Liver Disease. It's calculated based on the serum bilirubin, INR, and creatinine. And just to give you a sense of the numbers, above 30, the 1 month mortality rate is like around 53%. So 38, that's like really high.
Yeah. And steroids are the treatment for autoimmune hepatitis, but on her biopsy, it was about 80% necrosis. There weren't many normal hepatocytes left to try to save. So the hepatologists at this time were very skeptical that steroids would even be helpful, but we had to try.
And then you have more updates for us?
Oh, yeah. I was just telling these guys, just following up on the case, the patient actually just received a liver transplant not too long ago, and it's doing well.
Oh, yay.
Right. Yeah. All right. Yeah, so just to round out the case, I want to leave you guys with one teaching point about a framework for thinking about causes of acute liver injury and acute liver failure. I've talked before about a framework, I think on my YouTube channel, about like framing causes of cirrhosis. And you can use a very similar framework for thinking about acute liver injury and acute liver failure. So I think the best way to think about this is thinking about, like, you know, where all these like attacks can come from to the liver, upstream, downstream, or like within the liver itself. So upstream, thinking about like hepatic vein. These are things like hepatic vein thrombosis or Budd-Chiari syndrome. And then downstream, you mentioned earlier, Michael, biliary causes, things like PBC, PSC, cholangitis, or obstruction. I think these are more likely to lead to like cirrhosis, more like chronic issues, but I think it's good to keep in mind for the acute situations as well. And then we turn to the parenchyma within the liver itself. You know, the baddies are coming right at you. I had this mnemonic called Game It for cirrhosis. And basically, it's modified this, expanded it a little bit to game this for the acute situations and game it because we're using a mnemonic, you know, we're gaming the system. So that's how to remember that. So for G, think about genetic causes, things like hemochromatosis, Wilson's disease, alpha-1 antitrypsin. It gets a little complicated when you think about underlying liver disease or not and defining acute liver failure, but keep in mind genetic causes. Then the A, autoimmune hepatitis, like in our case. And then the ME of game is metabolic. So for acute situations, think about acute fatty liver of pregnancy. That's going to be the big metabolic cause. And then in the next part of this, toxins is the T. So acetaminophen, like I mentioned, that's one of the most common causes, like toxins, acetaminophen specifically know about, but also different antibiotics, anti-epileptics, antifungals, chemotherapeutic agents, death cap mushrooms. You know, watch out for those if you're in the woods. And herbal or dietary supplements.
I've seen a case of the alpha toxin.
Oh, wow.
Poisoning, yeah.
Wow.
And the next of the H for this, like hypoperfusion, so like shock liver or hepatectomy. So, you know, if you got, you're mucking around in the liver, some sort of surgical intervention, that can lead to acute liver injury. And then for, there's two I's actually to think about. One is infection. So hepatitis, which with acetaminophen and toxins is one of the most common, but also a host of other infections like CMV, EBV, HSV, and adenovirus. And then there's another I called infiltration. So that's things like malignancies or like granulomatous diseases. And then last, the last S to round out game this is stroke, specifically heat stroke. So that hopefully gives you a framework to, you know, keep in mind causes. Just remember upstream hepatic vein, downstream biliary causes, and then within the parenchyma itself. For the acute situations, game this. So yeah, hopefully that's a good takeaway for all of our listeners. Thank you very much, Nami and Michael, for joining. It's been very fun.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it was great.
Uh-huh. Congrats on the match again.
Okay.
Thank awesome. You.
Thanks again for listening. Person, time, and place. See you next time.